Hey everyone, today's fantasy book snowballed into six other massive hit books that inspired unprecedented millions of kids to read books, many of whom were otherwise uninterested in reading at the time, and then nothing else has done that since. So, at least all those dumb kids read seven books. Today we discuss Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone for the second time.
And this is The Book Pile,
a podcast about the best of books and the worst of books. If this is your first time on the podcast, welcome, and may we suggest checking out our back catalog of over 180 episodes with as many books. I'm Kellen Erskine. I'm a comic, a father, and as a good father, I would never send my child away to a school to not see them for 10 months out of the year, starting at the age when they've barely lost their baby teeth.
And I'm David Vance. Kellen, I connect with Harry's story because when I was a skinny white teen with glasses living in South America, you'll never guess what nickname the kids all screamed at me. Just everywhere. They would see me from a block away and go, "Harry Potter! Harry Potter!"
Oh, no.
I didn't know if they coordinated it. I didn't know if they all just came up with it right then. I still don't know if they were mocking me or just excited. And by the way, at the time, I was bright blonde.
At least that's more interesting. I lived in Brazil for 2 years, and no joke, the thing that kids yelled at me was, "Hey, German!" I do think it's funny that there is such a relatively large German population in South America, because I know in Brazil and Argentina as well. It's like when Germans saw how where World War II was going, they just looked at a map and they're like, "How about we head Kitty Corner?"
Like a chess bishop.
It's like Canada's so much closer. All right, as usual, consider subscribing to the podcast so you don't have to download it manually every week. Plus, it helps us out. And if you enjoy it, feel free to leave us a review. All right, first of all, before we get into how we feel about this book, I just need to say that I am excited to cover this book again. We've got brand new things to say about it. And now that I personally have almost got 200 episodes under my belt, I like to think that I'm not just better at expressing thoughts, but that I can do it in a way where I don't sound like I'm trying to be the expert of books, which is not what I was ever going for the first time around, yeah. But it's definitely how I used to come across, which you can hear for yourself if you dare to download the 8th episode we ever did. Also, on that episode, 172 episodes ago, Dave does an interesting job of re-explaining most of what I'm trying to say. So not only do I sound like I'm trying to be smart, but Dave constantly reminds me that I'm not. It's a gem.
Yeah, I found more subtle ways.
So, well, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone is the shortest and arguably a simpler story than the rest of the books. I think the one thing that she achieved with it over all the other books is that by its being the first book, it establishes this whole world, right? Characters, relationships, locations, histories, magic systems. And after all of that, after doing all that, she could build on it. But it started here where there wasn't anything before, and that takes an incredible amount of work.
Yeah.
It's like me when I write and fulfill my Costco shopping list, pure world building. I will say that there actually aren't that many magical rules set up in this book. A lot is built after, and that's fine with me because I'm not going to waste my time on a dumb conversation that starts with that sentence. But I do think that it's interesting that when building a world, you never know what you might end up embellishing later. Mm. Like in Star Wars, when I think of what you can do with the Force, the first thing that comes to mind with me is you can move stuff magically. You can move stuff across the room, right?
Yeah.
But it's different now that we have a dozen Star Wars movies and 900 episodes of Star Wars TV shows, which are all bankrupting Disney. But back when there was only one movie, A New Hope, nobody knew that you could use the Force to move stuff around. If that was the only piece of content to ever come out of that universe, we would all still think that the Force was just for hypnotizing security guards and helping you concentrate on your aim.
Yeah.
Right? It was essentially a mindfulness exercise. Also, something that occurred to me last night when I was writing jokes about Harry Potter at 3 a.m. was that when Obi-Wan gives Luke a lightsaber in A New Hope, Obi-Wan says that it's not as clumsy or random as a gun. And then at the end of the movie, Luke uses the Force to blow up the Death Star with a gun.
Yeah.
But what are your current thoughts on the Philosopher's Stone?
I liked it. It was a fun time. No, it was a good read.
Okay.
No, I too used to think it was a very simple book, and only when I started trying to write sci-fi books, children's books, did I realize all of the jobs that first book is doing very well. Mm-hmm. I do want to say J.K. Rowling is like if an author wished on a monkey's paw to always have a lot of buzz. We didn't talk about her tweets a ton when we did Harry Potter before, but I wanted to talk about it at least a little today, and then I just ended up talking to a loved one about it for 2 hours, so I'm so underprepped. So I'm going to talk about it in Chamber of Secrets, and I do have a feeling that wherever you fall on the political spectrum, you are going to love everything I say.
All right, if you'd like a way to get a book and support the podcast, you can purchase Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone or the Philosopher's Stone with the link in this episode's description. It's available in paperback, hardback, Kindle, or for free on Audible if you're a first-time subscriber. Speaking of which, Dave, this is the first time that I'd ever listened to this book on Audible, and I have to say, not super happy with all the voices. I know that you grew up with it, so you probably don't even hear it the way that I do. And I know that this guy has to do like 80 different characters just in this book alone, but he lost me when Ferenz, the big, strong, intimidating centaur, approaches the kids and says, "Harry? Harry Potter? What are you doing here?" It's very much.
See, I'm actually fine with that because I'm so bored in every centaur scene. The centaurs are my nominee for my least favorite characters.
Oh, yeah. They're the second worst characters for sure. But
oh, who's the... Oh, never mind. No, I'm not going to walk into this. I mean, I think the gimmick is supposed to be that they're interesting because they're so emotionless. And it's just so hard for that to be interesting.
It's like if Treebeard were a Vulcan. That's how entertaining the centaurs are. All right, and without further ado, here are three lessons that we took from Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. All right, lesson one. A memorable character can only say their own lines. Unless you're Tom Hanks and Claude Atlas, in which case you get to say six different people's lines. Oh, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's because you didn't see Claude Atlas and you were right. So J.K. Rowling is so great at this. Writing lines of dialogue that come from a unique point of view, which makes for stronger, definitive characters. One exercise that I made up for this is to ask, how would each of my characters respond to a dog peeing on their foot? Because if your current answer for each of your characters is they'd get real mad, then you might have some more work to do. Mm. And to prove how good J.K. Rowling is at this, at coming up with extremely character-specific dialogue, I want to ask you, Dave, I have a list of Harry Potter characters, and I want to ask you what you think their reactions would be if a dog peed on their foot. You ready?
Okay. Yeah.
Neville Longbottom.
Neville would probably get kind of sad, internalize some of his shame, and feel like it's his fault. And what would his grand think?
Hagrid.
Hagrid would be incredibly understanding. Like, of course a dog's going to pee on your foot. They're just dogs.
Hermione.
Hermione would immediately perform some spell to evaporate the urine. She would get a little flustered.
And I imagine that while she's doing all of that, she would say something like, honestly. Luna Lovegood.
Luna would, much like some people I met in the MLM world, revel in the healing powers of the urine.
She would pull her sleeve back to expose a bruise to the stream. Dumbledore.
Dumbledore would find the humor in it, quickly dry it off, and then go back to his very quiet Abe Lincoln-esque long-term depression. Sorry, is that too dark?
No, that's really funny. And then he'd be like, now I could really use some freaking new socks.
That's why he wants wool socks. They're more absorbent.
All right. All right, Voldemort. Just kidding, don't answer.
No, I actually do have an answer.
Okay.
So, I mean, obviously he kills the dog, but I think Voldemort is actually way more status conscious than we think. So I think his first thought after that would be, did any of my Death Eaters see? Because I don't think he can bear to be undignified. And if any Death Eater saw, I think he would do something like obliviate or kill them.
No, I think that's a good point. I think he kills the Death Eater and lets the dog go because in a way he respects it. But then he does put a Horcrux in it. Last one, Dobby.
Dobby would think he deserved it.
The dog pees on Dobby's leg. And then Dobby would start bending himself 180 degrees and hit his own head against his urine-soaked ankles.
Dobby would punish himself for getting in the way of the dog's stream.
And again, just using this dog peeing on your foot exercise, when I think of sort of bland cast, even for successful shows, like, I imagine that the cast of Friends, that every one of them would have the same reaction of, come on, other than Phoebe. Like, I couldn't tell you how each of them would individually react. And I don't want anyone's answers.
Ross would mope.
Okay.
Ross would mope and he would deserve to be peed on. He'd come into the apartment like Eeyore, like, hi. It's like, oh my gosh, how is this the leading man?
All right. Well, you'll say it. You've watched more Friends than me. You've read more Harry Potter than me, and you've watched.
Yeah, you're underestimating. You're underestimating my deep, specific hate for Ross.
So one of my takeaways from this is, if you're writing a story or a screenplay or a fun HR training video, just ask yourself: do each of my characters speak in a way that is true to them and no one else? Just listen to these examples and see how they're layered responses, and that they not only give us a sense of each character's specific way of communicating, but it tells us who each person is, because it often tells us what they want.
Yeah.
These are all just from the first Harry Potter book. My favorite line from Hermione: I hope you're pleased with yourselves. We could have all been killed, or worse, expelled. At one point, Filch says, hard work and pain are the best teachers, if you ask me.
He agrees with my grandpa. That's not a joke. My grandpa gives all the grandkids a speech about how a little suffering is good for the soul.
After Hagrid offers his coat to Harry to keep him warm, he says, don't mind if it wriggles a bit. I think I got a couple of dormice in one of the pockets. Then this quote: she's a nightmare. No wonder no one likes her. That's Ron in his typical manner of being mean to women. And George Weasley, who says, I suppose she thinks you don't forget your name, but we're not stupid. We know we're called Gred and Forge. Might be my favorite joke in the book, but it would have been less funny if someone else had said it. That's my point, because it would have been out of character. Like, imagine if during dinner, the headmaster grabs the charms teacher like, hey, look, everyone, it's us, Ditwick and Flumbledore. Like, the whole Great Hall would be like, okay.
Lesson two, make the emotion concrete. So, Kellen, writing teachers love to say show, don't tell. Specifically, they love to tell you that. And I think another way of putting it is make the emotion physical. So JK does that a lot. She takes any emotional thing and she makes it very concrete, very physical. For instance, emotionally, Harry is unloved. Well, physically, he lives in a cupboard under the stairs. He's in the house of his terrible aunt and uncle. Mm-hmm. By the way, don't you love that the Dursleys actually have a great marriage? They never fight. They have the same values. They hate the same person. Another example, emotionally, Harry finds out he's special. Well, physically, these mysterious letters come to him and they're getting weirder and weirder until a giant knocks down the door and tells him the story of how he's special. Emotionally, Harry wants a family. Physically, he sees a mirror where his family is completely visible to him.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's funny when Harry goes back a second time to visit that mirror and Dumbledore's there and Harry's like, whoa, how long have you been here? And Dumbledore says something like, not everyone needs a cloak to become invisible. But then he never does that again ever. And I like to think that it was just a huge fluke and that he was bluffing, like Dumbledore was actually just in there vaping. And then Harry barged in and he's like, oh, Harry. Oh, I know crazy magic.
That would fit with the theory that Dumbledore is just not that great of a headmaster. Objectively, what does he do as a headmaster where you're like, wow, that is good school administration? He's like wise and mentoring to exactly one character.
Sounds like you've spiraled down some Reddit comments, but I'm sure I'm going to read these with that filter now just to find how Dumbledore is somewhat capable at his job.
I'm just thinking, just in terms of running a school, I'm trying to think where I would mark him well.
All right. Lesson 3, take me on a ride. This is also what I say to every amusement park employee when I walk in the entrance and they try and sell me a photo package.
They cannot be making money on those, can they? I've never seen anyone buy them. No. Like, what's the scheme?
It used to make sense when not every single person on the planet had a 10K camera in their pocket.
Right.
Yeah. Are people really buying them? They're like, oh, cool, I get 50 wallet-sized ones? Sign me up.
Like, yeah, no, I bet this guy in the vest and the goatee knows all about natural lighting.
So take me on a ride. I don't even know how applicable this is to everyday life, but I noticed this time around how many parts of this book literally take us on a ride. We go on a train, on a minecart, on an oarless boat, on a broomstick, even on a giant chess piece, which would be the most boring ride. But you know that one nerdy executive at Universal Studios Orlando was like, hear me out. And the other board members are like, no. He's like, no, listen, it's not the Centaur ride idea again. This one's better. So adding a ride, I'm not even saying that it's even necessary for a story, but it certainly doesn't hurt a magic story.
Yeah.
Also, I know it's easy to analyze this book to death and draw the wrong conclusions as to why it works so well. Like it would be just as simple to say that this book sold 120 million copies because it had lots of treacle tarts in it. So I'm not saying I'm onto something, but I think it at least adds up to an even more of a magical feeling in this magic series. I was thinking about the other books in this series and realized that in every story, when Harry Potter crosses the first threshold to adventure, it's on a magical ride, like it could be in an amusement park.
Yeah.
So first book is a train. Second book's a flying car. Third book is the night bus, which I have a big problem with, but we can address that. We can cross that bridge when we come to it. The fourth book.
Kellen is a night bus truther.
The fourth book, it's a port key. The fifth book, they're on brooms with the Order of the Phoenix. The sixth book is apparating with Dumbledore. And the sixth.
Keep it.
I just made two blunders in 30 seconds. Can you tell I've read these books 3 times and you've read them 3-digit times?
Have you really only read them 3 times?
I think that's a fair...
Wow.
That's a fair question to ask an adult, right?
Well, no, you just talk about them a ton for having only read them 3 times.
Yeah, I have an incredible memory, Dave. I just go back and think of the entire book when I want to revisit it. Do you actually go back and... No, I'm just kidding.
I do that with the time you were kind to me.
It's definitely under 6 times, but it sounds like that doesn't make it better on your scoreboard. Also, you know how in book 6, when Harry sees Thestrals pulling carriages, which were invisible to him until he had seen death, how much less impressive of a reveal would that have been if instead of carriages, every year they had just kept using those little boats for the first years? And then when he's 16, Harry looks at them and sees that each of the boats actually has a weird little like skeletal outboard motor. I just like the image of like Hagrid standing there behind one of the little boats just pulling on the air, and it's like, what is that? You'll find out after you see death. Another thing about that too, and I'm not
Yeah, go to the school 1 year and you'll be able to see it.
This time around, I'm not here to roast every plot hole of every book, but it is funny to me, the Thestral thing, because that's obviously something that was added later. Because if that, I know how kids are, and this is how adults are too, but kids especially love to make you feel stupid for not knowing something. Day one, you know that everyone would be spreading it around, like the way that kids say it. You know that invisible horses pull these, right? Gotta see death if you want to see them. You didn't know that?
One of the kids who's like grandpa had died would trick you into stepping in something invisible and squishy. How would you wash it off?
I could say, I think my thing would be, hey, just punch the air right here. And it would just be, you know, right into Thestral balls. So yeah, not sure how helpful this takeaway is, but I can promise you that rides are always fun. So put them in your story or your family vacation or even make them at home. Your kids will love you. And I'm not even basing that on my experience. I'm basing it off of the second Ant-Man movie, you know, when Paul Rudd makes a 3-story slide out of cardboard down the staircases of his house and his daughter really loves him for it in that true story. By the way, I'm listening to a book on the history of Disneyland, and essentially the seed that turned into the idea of Disneyland all started with one man who built a small train as a ride in his backyard, and that man is, yeah, you guessed it, Walt Disneyland. Can you imagine? For an 11th tangent, it's so funny to me, like, that how the stars align. Like, Walt Disney's so lucky that he just had a whimsical last name. Can you imagine, though, like, just
Erskine Land,
the arrogance that it would seem like if you called a place, yeah, your surname plus land.
All right, random facts. Kellen, do you think when Fox is putting the moves on Lady Phoenixes that he brags about how his feathers only go to the most powerful wizards?
The way that Dumbledore describes the Mirror of Erised sounds like he's cautioning us against social media. He says, "This mirror will give us neither knowledge nor truth. Men have wasted away before it, entranced by what they have seen, or been driven mad not knowing if what it shows is real or even possible." No joke, I know someone who flew to see the eclipse because of how amazing it looked in TikTok videos.
No.
Yeah.
How did they feel?
I haven't talked to him or her yet about it. I also flew to see the eclipse, but I've also, like, I've been a fan of astronomy my whole life. And this person was like, "It gets pitch black. You see all the stars." And I was like, "I don't think that happens."
Yeah, you don't.
Yeah. I mean, it was still amazing. It was still one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. It was hypnotizing. Mm-hmm. But I think Mars, it was Mars or Jupiter was out, so you could see a planet. So no stars, but one planet. And it didn't get completely dark. You know, I mean, you've been through one too. You know, it's just sort of, it looks like, yeah, sort of like sunset all around you. But it's not nearly like the turn off your flashlights in a cave sort of dark magic that I think he was expecting.
From TikTok, from all the filters. Ours happened, so this was the 2018 one. It passed, the totality passed through my hometown, Idaho Falls. I had a bunch of little cousins there. When the sky went dark, all the little boys started running in a circle and howling like wolves. I don't think they coordinated it at all. It just happened.
Weird.
And then on the ride back, what would have been a short drive was 8 hours long because Idaho roads were never designed for Idaho Falls to be popular. So the least realistic part of Harry Potter 1 is when they save the life of the most annoying girl in their class and then become her friend.
I don't know. I bristle a little bit at calling Hermione the most annoying. Don't you think that you were a bit of a Hermione growing up in school?
I think I am now.
As you just corrected me.
Actually.
Honestly.
I look back and there are times when I'm like, wait, why wasn't I bullied? I never remember thinking that a lot of things I was very nerdy about were anything short of the coolest thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I'm not arguing. I was off-putting in a different way that I still thought was cool. I had these hiking boots that I wore through half of my teen years that they were very big. They're a little too big for me, but I could lace them up, like well up my ankle. And when I pulled them tight, I just felt bigger and stronger. But it's like I thought that everyone else felt the same about me while I wore them. And
but sometimes that's all you need.
To me, it's like the white guy who's listening to hip hop very loudly in his cars with the windows down. And how cool he feels is how much he thinks everyone perceives him as he sits at the stoplight.
Have I told you about the time I went to the house of a coworker I didn't know that well, and we're walking back out to my car, and I turn on my car with the windows down, forgetting that I'm listening to an audiobook about evolution, and then just loudly, we both hear instructions for artificial duck insemination.
I mean, what do you do at that point?
I'm not joking when I say I literally just never saw him again. There was this Christmas break when I was home with my family, and I was listening to this audiobook for a book club I was in. Very tame audiobook, but as soon as a little sibling walked into the room, one of the only dirty parts in the book would just blare through my phone speaker.
Like duck insemination again? What is with this guy?
How does this keep always happening?
Not to go off on a Quidditch tangent, one of the least thrilling things about watching Quidditch has got to be most of those games, there's no way that anyone sees the seeker catch the snitch, right? Like, yeah. They're flying all over the place. There are zero boundaries for that thing. Like, I bet most games end with the seeker just flying back into the stands like, I got it, everyone. Game over.
Like, okay. Dude, I have to tell where a hockey puck is based on context clues.
I was thinking the other day how amazing it would be if half of all hockey games had to be played on black ice.
Kellen, if I were the most powerful dark wizard in history and had failed to kill a child for like four times, I would be furious to find out from my spy that the kid is like a B-minus student.
Speaking of Tom Hanks playing several characters, I've had the privilege recently to work pretty closely with Chris Ewan, who's he worked with Sony Animation for years, and he's produced, he's been like a digital effects producer as well. He worked on like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 1 and 2. And he worked with Robert Zemeckis for a while. And he said that when they were making the Polar Express, that one of the reasons why it looks as odd as it does is that, first of all, it's all motion capture. And it was still sort of in its nascent state. But the other part is he said that Zemeckis hates working with children. because Chris, he also pushed for the movie, the Polar Express movie, to be live action with like CG special effects, which I think would have been, you know, 10 times better and 10 times less creepy. But Zemeckis just can't stand working with kids so much that all of the kids that are animated, all the child characters that are animated in the Polar Express movie are adults.
No.
They were adults doing motion capture.
For kids?
Just adults with green ping pong balls glued to a bodysuit. And yeah, all of the actors were...
And that failed to capture a sense of childlike wonder?
You know how Back to the Future had a different, they cast a different actor and shot it for the first 3 weeks of production. Don't you think when they then brought in Michael J. Fox, who's like a full foot and a half shorter than everyone else, that the first time Zemeckis turned around, he's like, oh, no. Oh, God.
He's got wandering around his sets. He has like the child catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
What a crazy reference.
It will mean nothing to a lot of people, but if it means anything to you, it means something terrible.
Yes.
Kellen, I know you get a lot of jokes about your name. I read an article about a kid living your version of hell because he was named Harry Potter before the books came out. He says, after 12 years of it, I couldn't count the amount of times I've heard, "You're a wizard, Harry." I've heard all the puns about my wand. I'm the only person at work who doesn't have to use my full name when I'm talking on the phone. He even has a scar on his forehead, but his is from running into a lamppost.
Oh, no. What? At one point, Dumbledore says, "I would trust Hagrid with my life." I wouldn't.
Yeah, same. I mean, the chronology of that day is wild. Because Dumbledore is like, oh, word, Lily and James are dead, and Harry's an orphan, and Voldemort's dead? No, I don't need to stop by. Hey, where's my one guy who can't do magic? Can my slowest guy go pick up that baby? No, the baby will be fine.
And just never follow up.
I know I poke fun, but the honest truth is that the books were entertaining enough that I have read them enough times to notice discrepancies.
Yeah.
All the books I hate have, I'm sure, as many plot holes per page. It's just I don't read them enough times to notice them all.
Right. You don't read them more than three times.
Yeah, I'm like ballpark three.
Speaking of stories, I find this that anytime I write in any story or any script, essentially what I've done is create a narrative with 1,000 mistakes.
Sure.
And then the job in rewriting is not to make it perfect, because you never will. One of the jobs in rewriting is just to find and eliminate as many of those as you can.
Yeah.
Because what we don't see are all the great solutions that J.K. Rowling came up with.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
It's almost like, especially when you're writing fantasy with magical systems and everything, when you're doing your job right, the reader just doesn't notice.
I'll say this too. Life is so incredibly complicated. And in real life, when something happens that doesn't make sense, we say, huh. In a book, when something happens that doesn't make sense, we say, aha!
Yeah.
Caught at last.
Yeah, it really is
a loser. This proves that this story is not physically real.
It is like a lose-lose for an author, because like you can either try and fix a mistake and people point out what you did wrong, or you can even throw in like a coincidence, and that's even worse because people say coincidence. Yeah, you can't have a coincidence in a story, even though, as you've mentioned, Dave, coincidences happen in life all the time.
Yeah.
We just don't like to see them in the movies that we choose to watch.
Yeah, you want everything to mean something. Mm-hmm. Even though there's so much in life that means nothing. My brother Ben wrote a short story about this guy who gets randomly killed by getting hit by a tire. Mm. And the ending talks about how there were all these different realities in which that death did not happen. And yet in this reality, his friends took so many lessons away from it. So Kellen, the Slytherins think pure bloods are superior. And the Purebloods have won the House Cup 6 years in a row. So I don't know, maybe. Also, maybe the Gryffindors lose every year because McGonagall always docks them 150 points.
Speaking of maybe not plot holes, but just interesting story choices. Of all the magical protections put in place to protect the Sorcerer's Stone, the fact that the part of it is a chess game. It's the only one that doesn't have anything to do with magic, right? Like, to get in there, you have to know how to get past this magical beast. And then you have to know how to untangle yourself from magical plants. And then you have to be able to fly in a magic broom around these enchanted keys. And then you also just have to be great at a board game.
Yeah, how's your mid game? How many openings do you know? I mean, we've talked about before how the other wild thing is that the challenges are designed to be beaten. Mm-hmm. Like, McGonagall could have just had statues who beat you up if you're not supposed to be there, but it's like, no.
Yeah. I'm going to throw this fan theory out there. Maybe McGonagall's a squib. They're like, hey, so what's your complicated enchantment? And she's like, well, she's poking around her game cupboard. The Monopoly would be too cheesy.
Like, Snape straight up could have just had one that sends you through and the rest are poison. But he's like, no, but if they're smart enough, they deserve it. All right, to recap, our favorite lessons from Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. 1, a memorable character can only say their own lines. 2, make the emotion concrete. 3, take me on a ride.
And 4, a third Tom Hanks movie that you can skip is Joe versus the Volcano.